from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Once there was a princess.
Was the princess you?
And she fell in love.
Well, coming up in Forums next hour, Bay Area journalist and author Peggy Ornstein joins us to talk about girly girl, retro, overly feminized culture and how it's affecting this nation's daughters. Why are tot and tween girls increasingly turning to the models of pink girlhood identify with Disney princesses? And should we be worried about it? Peggy Ornstein, herself the mother of a young daughter, thinks so. Cinderella Ate My Daughter is the title of her new book, and she'll join us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Girly girl culture is upon us. So Peggy Ornstein reveals to us in her most recent book, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, a combination of personal memoir and what she calls dispatches from the front lines of the new girly girl culture. Actually, it's all maybe a lot more retro than new. Princesses like Sleeping Beauty and tiaras and lots of pretty in pink. But let's talk about numbers. In 2009, Disney Princess products increased their generated revenue from $300 million to $4 billion, and there are currently over 26,000 Disney Princess products. Peggy Ornstein worries that all of this emphasis on girly girl culture affects girls as they mature from being tots and tweens, making them more vulnerable to depression, distorted body images, eating disorders, and sexually risky behaviors. Author of Waiting for Daisy and a contributing writer with the New York Times Magazine, Peggy Ornstein's work has also appeared in Vogue, Elle, USA Today, The New Yorker, Salon, Parenting, The Oprah Magazine, and The Los Angeles Times. She contributes commentary to NPR's All Things Considered, and she joins us in studio for this morning's second Forum Hour. Good to have you back. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks, Michael.
Well, you were just telling me off the air about something with
breaking news.
Yeah, this is exclusive. We're hearing about Miley Cyrus on the Forum program, but
right.
I think it's certainly
it's actually relevant. Yeah. Yesterday, Billy Ray Cyrus, Miley's dad, came out and said that he regretted ever having put her on, which he called that damn show, and that Hannah Montana is a dirty word in his house. It has destroyed his marriage, destroyed his family, and his daughter is a train wreck. And what was particularly interesting about that to me was that just, I'd say, 3 years ago, Miley was on Barbara Walters, where Barbara said she was the antidote to all the teen train wrecks that, you know, that these other girls who were train wrecks for your daughter, that she's, because that's how these girls are marketed, is that they come out as role models. And so she used to wear that, you know, the true love waits ring that said you're going to be a virgin when you get married. And she would say things like, I try to choose clothes that parents approve of and girls will love, and I'm really young looking and I want to stay that way. You know, and then 3 months later, she's dancing on a stripper pole. And there's this way, and this is getting a little ahead of the conversation, but I think that you can't make wholesomeness into a marketing gimmick without making what comes after into a marketing gimmick too. And what those girls model is self-objectification as a kind of feminine rite of passage for
girls.
How
can you sell wholesomeness when the other is so ubiquitous? I mean, it's pervasive. It's endemic to the culture. I mean, the sexualization and all the pole dancing and all those kinds of things. Let's come. I want to get to all
let's
that.
Get back.
As you say. Yeah, because I want to get to the sort of the gist and the pith of a lot of what you write about here. Before we go there, and what we sort of begin with is this recent wave of feminism. And I think about waves of feminism. I think about maybe we're in the fourth wave or something, doesn't seem to have had the impact. It was pushed aside, it was sidestepped. And again, as I said in my introduction, almost seems like we're looking retro to tiaras and princess costumes and pink stuff. Pretty much, in your judgment, this is the thesis I think you're working with, kind of tamped up by, obviously, mass marketing. But we go to a guy named Andy Mooney. He's the genius here, isn't he?
The evil genius.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think what's interesting is that that there's two things kind of existing simultaneously. You know, you talk about the sort of the sidestepping of the feminist progress and all of that. But, you know, girls are doing really well. they're doing great in school. They're doing great on the playing field. They're going to college in record numbers. And yet this pressure to define themselves and make the epicenter of their identity, their appearance, has not abated one whit, and it's gotten younger. And so this whole princess phenomenon that you can't – I mean, if you have a daughter that is under the age of five – you know, I don't even have to get the word out of my mouth. You know what I'm talking about. But it really began 10 years ago. And here is what's different was that it used to be that these movies would come out, Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, you know, whatever. And they would be out for a few weeks. There'd be a little merchandise around them. Maybe they'd come out on VHS. And then what Disney would say is they'd go back in the vault. And they wouldn't come around again for 7 years till there was a new crop of children. The marketing would go away. The merchandise would go away. And then this guy, Andy Mooney, got this idea. He was the new head of consumer products to take the female characters from the movies and for the first time ever in the history of Disney, market characters separate from a film's release. And he put them out there all together and with an array of products, mostly gowns and slippers and makeup and things like that. And within the first year, they made $300 million, and by 2010, they were a $4 billion industry with 26,000 products, which, you know, 26,000, you know, you think they can't do cars, liquor, cigarettes, tampons, antidepressants, you know, where 26,000, you don't even think of 26,000 products, but that launch, that success, that juggernaut launched this whole kind of culture-wide phenomenon where you cannot move now without bumping into a pink princess.
And those who remember your last book know that it launched your daughter, or met your daughter Daisy in your last book, it launched her. I mean, so she's wearing overalls one day, and the next day she's begging for a pink dress and plastic heels.
Right. So my daughter, I was going along. I'm a mom now, and, you know, how the mighty fall. It's always a humbling experience to be a parent. And so we were going along, you know.
In fact, you were not thinking, excuse me for interrupting,
yeah.
You were thinking maybe it would be better if I had a boy because I've written so much about girls.
Yeah. I was worried about the whole situation. So I was raising my daughter and thinking, you know, I want her to feel like she can be anything she can be. There's nothing she has to do. You know, there's nothing that's limited to her. There's nothing that's off limits. And then she went to preschool and she came back having memorized, as if by osmosis, the names and gowns, colors of the Disney princesses. And we would go around, and I live in Berkeley, you know, so you can imagine. What's going on elsewhere. So we
was your dentist in Berkeley?
The dentist, the famous dentist. Yeah. So we're going around and people are saying, you know, hello, you know, hi. A friend of mine just had an ultrasound. She said she had been sort of not so sure about, you know, that I was not overreacting about this. And they told her that the text said, you're having a little princess. And I said, boy, that crown's going to hurt coming out, man. But we don't even have girls anymore. So we finally went to
the dentist. We should annotate the dentist, though. It was a princess thrill, right?
Yes. We went to the dentist, and she said, you want to get in my princess chair so I can sparkle your teeth? And I said, oh, my God, do you have a princess drill, too? Because I just thought, I just didn't remember this. You know, I remembered playing princess occasionally as a little girl. I did not remember this 24/7, 365 day a year for 3 years. This period where girls not only play princess, but they are princesses walking around town. I thought
your daughter was one lying on the ground.
My
with
daughter
some boys
was one,
around her.
Yeah, at my niece's bat mitzvah. Yeah, and you know, sort of just trying to figure out like
playing.
Was this a good thing? Was it protective, or was it priming them for sexualization?
Well, some would say just a phase, right?
Of course, it's a phase. I mean, there's very few girls. Well, I used to think there were very few girls going to college in their princess dresses, but you know, now you can get married in a Disney princess wedding gown, like a grown-up Disney. And I'm sort of waiting for the Snow White coffin. But
well, you mentioned being at a bat mitzvah. There's, in fact, you allude to all those Jewish American princess jokes, which often are kind of thinly veiled anti-Semitic thing. But at the same time, there's great pride in those jokes, you know, because the Jewish American princess, we find out through those jokes, as sort of portals, are so affluent and well-to-do and so spoiled because of success in materialistic ways, right?
I guess. I mean, in my community, that was something that we really, I mean, at least, you know, my parents raised me that was really not, you
know,
not okay.
Yeah.
It was obnoxious and not okay. However, being Queen Esther, that was pretty good.
Well, better queen than a princess? I don't know. But the title, Cinderella Ate My
mm-hmm,
Daughter.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
cannibalism that you're working with here.
Yeah, because, you know, for a couple, that title one thing about that title was I wanted to signal a kind of tone in the book, which is conversational and somewhat, you know, I feel like I'm kind of in my Elvis Costello phase where I used to be disgusted, but now I'm just amused, except I'm also disgusted. But you know, I feel like you have to kind of fight fun with fun. So if you're going to go up against this stuff, you better be as entertaining as it is. So part of it was that, and that's why there's sparkles all over the cover of the book as well. It's ironic glitter.
Yeah, but they don't come off.
They do. They do.
Oh, they haven't come off yet.
I have been told they come off. I'm sorry. They do. I'm sorry. But it's also because it was this all-consuming thing. And what, you know, what it does is ultimately this sort of princess industrial complex, this giant press of princess and pink and pretty, which seems so benign, really what we're seeing is that girls are being encouraged from an unprecedentedly young age to define themselves through appearance, through beauty, and through kind of sassiness, which is the kind of, you know, marketer's code word for girls for pre-sexiness.
But they're also supposed to be alpha girls now and superior in their accomplishments, like you said. It's almost as if these are kind of two separate images that girls have for themselves, even though some of the images happen to be, I don't know, Britney Spears, Lindsay Lohan. I mean, part of it is, of course, the celebrity culture, too, which impinges on them.
Yeah. And that those two things existing simultaneously, you know, they're contradictory. And it's really hard on girls. So what they express when you look into sort of research on surveys of girls is that they feel this pressure, even down in elementary school, to be simultaneously, it's as if we've layered these new expectations over the old ones and then sort of not dealt with the impact of the old ones. So they feel simultaneously like they're supposed to be, you know, getting straight A's in school, doing, you know, in leadership positions, you know, captain of the swim team, whatever, and they're supposed to be pretty and thin. And increasingly, girls in elementary school since 2000, which I don't think it's an accident that it dovetails with when this princess stuff started, girls in elementary school are expressing more concern about weight and body, and that that's going up, and concern about their schoolwork is going down.
I want to talk about that with you as well. We're talking, by the way, with Peggy Ornstein. Her new book is Cinderella Ate My Daughter, local Bay Area Berkeley-based journalist and author. And there are statistics that, certainly alarm parents and should alarm parents that come with this book. The percentage of 8 to 12-year-olds who regularly used eyeliner doubled between 2008 and 2010. Nearly half of girls between the ages of 6 and 9 regularly use lipstick or lip gloss. This has a lot to do with, again, the sexualization and the commercialization of a lot of that sexualization that we've been talking about here. And the statistics are alarming. And it may have a great deal to do also with the kind of things you see vis-a-vis pedophilia and, you know, NBC's programs where they trap predators who are pedophiles and so forth, because to catch a predator. But let's put it in another context. You're talking about Cinderella, but at one point you say maybe you're talking about the stepsisters, you know?
Yeah.
That what we're raising are spoiled, materialistic, narcissistic kids, despite the messages that are going out, be superior and all that. And you use these examples that I find curious of Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian, two people who are famous for being famous,
for
I
being
guess.
Famous,
I
mean, right.
I don't know what they've accomplished. Or for making porn films, or well, Kim Kardashian's with her boyfriend. Well, they were both with their boyfriend, I guess. But there's a kind of vapidity and shallowness. I'm not being too judgmental here, am I? That comes
go for
across,
it.
That comes across to I mean, a father of daughters, too, that says this is the message, you know.
And
this
and I think that that's, you know, you have to, it's really, being a parent is a really present tense proposition. So when you've got a 3-month-old, you can't imagine having a 6-year-old. And when you have a 6-year-old, you probably don't want to imagine having a 13-year-old. And so it's hard to sort of for parents to connect the dots and see the context of the girl culture. And that's what I wanted to be able to provide, was this sort of toddler to tween arc. And one of the things that the princess culture is trying to funnel girls into is a kind of narcissism. And what I for instance, Daisy, my daughter, when she was 7, she got for her birthday a make-your-own messenger bag kit. And it had, you know, the expected hearts and flowers. It was iron-on transfers that you had to put on. And then it had transfers that said spoiled, brat, and pampered princess. And, you know, to her credit, she said, Mom, why would anybody put that on their purse? But it got me thinking that, you know, I was really involved in the girl power movement. And there's this way, I call it girls power with a Z now, you know, Thai girls, brats, all that sort of thing, that those ideas of kind of, I hate the word empowerment, but, you know, empowerment and self-empowerment and agency and independence and self-sufficiency and ability over beauty, those have become distorted by the culture so that the way you express them and the way you express your power is through a kind of narcissism, through putting spoiled on your T-shirt or, you know, give me the credit card and nobody gets hurt.
I don't think Facebook helps all that either, do you? I mean,
it's
sort of
interesting.
Encourages a narcissistic.
There has been a statistical rise among college students in rates of narcissism and a drop in empathy in the last 20 or so years, particularly accelerating after 2000. And I think social media is some of that. I think for girls, social media, you know, all kids have that, you know, desire to be popular and wear the right clothes and all of that. But what we're seeing is that kids now craft both their online and offline identity in response to how it's taken by those 622 best friends forever that you've got online.
Self-performance, essentially.
Yeah, performance and sculpting their identity in accordance with that. And for girls, you know, almost like a brand. You become a brand. So identity is something that you're performing instead of something that's coming out internally or you're developing internally. And for girls, that means what they get response for is being sexy but not too sexy. So it's that same line that girls have always walked of trying to be, you know, sexy but not slutty, which I guess to me in part, you know, it shows the lie of the idea that this sexualized culture is somehow, you know, liberating girls and making them freer if they're still struggling with that same old conundrum, but now just in an exponentially bigger way.
Well, it's making them do more sexting. I mean, one of the statistics that really caught my attention was, and I don't know, it almost seemed questionable to me, to tell you the truth, a quarter of teen girls have posted nude or semi-nude photos of themselves online?
Yeah, I know. That was interesting to me. And, you know, I was feeling, too, like maybe we were in this sex panic.
And, or maybe this is inflated. You know?
Yeah, that maybe it was inflated. And also, you know, I want to say there's a lot on the internet that's wonderful, you know, wonderful for girls and boys, too, places that they can, communities and places they can go that offer a lot of wonderful alternative balancing out images. But I was thinking that very thing, like, this is ridiculous. And then a friend of mine was looking on her son's computer, her 14-year-old son's computer in Berkeley, and found a picture of a classmate, a girl, female classmate, naked from the waist up, 14, and not even somebody he knew very well. And so she said to me, you know, how am I supposed to teach my son that women are not playthings if a girl is sending him a picture like this? And I had to really, you know, I thought, well, gee, it's really easy to talk about girls as victims. But what happens when they do this themselves? I mean, could it be conceived as, you know, powerful or in control of their sexuality, even though they immediately lose control because it can be, you know, sent
they
all over
the place.
They
were getting that message, many of them, that you have to be in control of your own sex. You're as equal as boys, well, and you can be as blatant about your, you can be testosterone-like in your aggressions about sex.
Which would be okay, except that I don't think that is what's going on. I think what's going on sexual entitlement has sort of become the latest performance for girls. So rather what I try to do is distinguish between sexuality and sexualization. So sexuality is what we want to cultivate in our daughters, which is a connected feeling that is embodied, that is about knowing your own desire, which leads you to being able to, you know, say yes or say no in an authentic way. And sexualization is this thing that's performed outside, from the outside in, and is about being desirable rather than understanding your own desire. And when I talked to researchers about this, and was sort of wrestling with this phenomenon of what this, that, you know, we're getting with older kids now, obviously, what this sexting meant, what these sorts of performance things that girls were doing meant, she said, you know, what I see is when I ask girls about how an experience of arousal felt, teenage girls, they respond by telling me how they think they looked. And I have to tell them that looking good is not a feeling.
Or they think about how the boy responds.
Well, right? That's what they're saying, right? They're thinking about,
they're being mirrored by
evoking
him
and provoking desire, but not feeling it themselves. And that's, you know, that's not what we want for our daughters. And premature sexualization, by which I mean learning from a very young age to see yourself and judge yourself as you think others see you, you know, am I the fairest of them all, is really strongly linked to disconnecting from sexuality and disconnecting from your erotic feelings and learning, because you're too young to understand what you're doing, really, learning from the get-go that femininity and sexuality are performance, not something that you feel internally.
And aren't more girls doing cyberbullying, too, than boys? I mean, that's a curious phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah.
Talking about empowerment.
I think, you know, girls have always sort of engaged in that kind of relational aggression. But then when you take it online, you know, it's explosive and it can just go a whole lot further. So, I mean, I feel like I'm being very bad news here, when I feel like I have a lot of good news too. But, you know, but these are the issues I think parents are contending with and concerned about.
Indeed they are. And it almost compels one to look philosophically. Forgive me for that. But, you know, get into nature and nurture. And you say, mm-hmm. I don't want Disney making decisions for me. I want to make decisions as a parent and make them, you know, in the best interest of my child, which I think, you know, most any caring and concerned parent would certainly say rah-rah to and bravo.
Right.
But there is a sense of not knowing. I was just reading your book and thinking about my experiences in a preschool when I was with all mothers.
Right.
In fact, at one
right.
point, the woman who's in charge said, Michael, you and the other mothers, come here, we're baking cookies today. But the sense was that everything, and this is true, I'm sure, in Berkeley to a fault almost, you know, everything wanted to be sexually equal, gender equal, have the boys play with dolls, have the girls play with
right.
other kind. It just didn't. There was
That's
too
right.
much influence from
That's
outside.
Right.
The boys want to play with swords and be Ninja Turtle.
Just influence from outside, though. I mean, I do.
Well, maybe it is nature.
That I do a chapter on nature and nurture, because I think you really can't talk about these issues without going to that. And that sort of idea of creating opposite, or saying, you know, you play with trucks and you play with dolls, because that's
doesn't
you know,
work.
That's not equal, and it's not developmentally appropriate, really. And for kids that age. In that preschool year, those preschool years, it's really important to them to assert their sex as stridently as possible, because they're in a phase of life where they don't understand the whole anatomy issue, and that most of us are going to stay the sex we're born with unless we go to some, you know, measures. So to them...
I've never heard it described as measures before.
just trying to be fair to the spectrum, okay? I'm being fair to the spectrum, but let's just give it that. So unless you as far as they're concerned, you could grow up to be a mommy or a daddy. And the way – and that's why – and you want to stay the sex you are, and they don't understand the – so the way that you are a girl is you wear barrettes. And so that's why your three-year-old, even when you're raising her in your, you know, your – sensory deprivation feminist box, is suddenly won't let you wrestle her into pants, because she needs to say, I'm a girl, I'm a girl, I'm a girl. That's, and also toy choice in preschool is one of the biggest differences between the sexes over the entire lifespan. Girls going for dolls, boys going for trucks.
Kevin just sent me a message that a Berkeley parent he knew gave his son a Barbie doll to play with as an effort to diversify his gender interests. And the kid ran around pointing the doll at his friends going, bang, bang, you're dead. We're coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number. We're talking to Peggy Ornstein, and her new book is Cinderella Ate My Daughter. A lot of sparkle on it. The subtitle is Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture. Feel free to join us. It's toll-free, and you can do that now at 866-733-6786. Welcome to the conversation. Again, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, 866-733-6786, or send an email to forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Berkeley-based journalist and author Peggy Ornstein. Her new book is Cinderella Ate My Daughter. And, well, I got to give Peggy some kudos here, because when she went out looking for answers to this whole question of what's happening to young girls, including her daughter, she did some sorts of things that only a dogged journalist would do, like going to a Miley Cyrus concert and going to the child pageant circuit and Toy Fair, which was like
so
an ocean of pink.
To. Yeah,
no, I thank you for that. Also, we should probably mention that there are many Cinderella stories, which I suppose
yes.
many of our listeners know. There are about 500, including a very different one from the Brothers Grimm. But there was a but before
yes,
we went
yes,
to
yes,
I don't
yes.
mean with two T's. I
yes,
mean with one.
Yes, I left that in a bad spot. I wanted to say, you know, so girls will naturally want to be girls. Boys will naturally want to be boys in preschool. So that's why that sort of princess thing is developmentally genius, because they'll latch onto whatever's extreme in the culture. When I was a little kid, that meant buggies, baby dolls, dollhouses. Now it's princess and makeup. That said, it's really important. So one thing is, you can give your daughter alternative things that celebrate, you need to, that celebrate and expand her ideas of what feminine means. But the other piece that really changed how I parented was what I learned about cross-sex friendships and the importance of cross-sex friendships, and that the little differences between boys and girls become big gaps if they grow up in separate gendered cultures. And so you find things that, like, girls with older brothers have better spatial skills than girls with older sisters or boys with older sisters. And boys mm-hmm. from more egalitarian families are more nurturing than boys from less egalitarian families. So that means, you know, their brains are the most plastic when they're little. You know, they're in terms of neuroplasticity, and they're laying down tracks for how they're going to be later. So when they have that contact with the other sex, it changes them cognitively, psychologically, emotionally. Kids who have friends of the other sex in elementary school have better dating relationships.
The neuroscience pretty much backs this up.
The neuroscience totally backs the plasticity. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's like language. You know, if you
pick it up much easier.
Well, and that you're born knowing how to do, you know, how to make all sounds, and then you learn the sounds of your language, and you can't make other sounds anymore. So it's a similar thing. And so when your daughter is sitting there in her pink room, in her pink princess dress, reading Pinkalicious, you know, with her pink Scrabble set that says F-A-S-H-I-O-N across the cover, and that really exists, it's very hard to reach across and have those friendships that, you know, that will happen otherwise.
Didn't a little boy run past Daisy, a kid named Thomas, saying, "Girls don't like trains," waving a train or something like that?
He was talking about Thomas Train.
His name wasn't Thomas. So
yeah.
There you go.
And it worked pretty quickly. I mean, she shoved that right down to the bottom of her toy box, you know?
I want to get to our callers. A couple of things, though. There was a new study in Allure magazine. I don't know what kind of stock we should put in Allure magazine, but it was fascinating because it said that Hispanic and African-American women, young women, are twice as likely to feel positive and confident about their looks mm-hmm. and about their bodies.
Mm-hmm. That's been study after study shows that. Yeah. Oh, I don't know about
Latina. So we're talking about.
I haven't seen that so much about Latina women. I've seen that about African American women. But what's interesting is that there's also studies that show that when African American women, young women, are exposed to unrealistic images of African American women's bodies, when they see a lot of videos with unrealistic portrayals, you know, super skinny or super, you know, voluptuous and super skinny of African American women, it affects their body image. Not so much when they see images of white women. They sort of apparently, and you know, this is research. This isn't anything I can tell you from experience. Obviously, disconnect from that somehow.
We have the First Lady now on a mission to try to fight obesity mm-hmm. in children, and obesity in children has gotten exponential in terms mm-hmm. of its expansion. But the fact of the matter is, as you indicated earlier, young girls are more and more into the idea that being thin means being feminine, being sexy, being appealing, and therefore we have eating disorders and we have all of these problems that have plagued
us. Right, and we have them skewing younger. But, you know, when you bring up the Michelle Obama's food fight, that's one of the things that sort of gives me hope, because I feel like, you know, when we talk about media and we talk about toys and such with our kids, we use the same language as with food. We talk about consuming. And so I sort of start to think about this and about the response the book has gotten, which has been terrific, as sort of being like the food movement, and the way that 10 years ago, you know, who knew what trans fat was? Who cared if your chicken was in a cage or not before you ate it, mm-hmm. right? And because of a couple of books, because of, you know, Omnivore's Dilemma, Fast Food Nation, there's been
sort
of
national
change.
You people in Berkeley, you and Pollen, really trying to change this
culture.
We're
trying to change this culture. If Michael can do it, I can too. Dang it.
Let's get to our callers, and we'll bring you in first. Liz, hi, you're on.
Hi, thanks very much. I would like to thank Peggy so much for trying to change this culture. Just as an aside, I saw one of the Kardashians on Parenting Magazine when I was in the dentist recently, and I was horrified. But my question is, how do you address the issue of the fact that Cinderella is saved or validated by her Prince Charming. How is that playing into, you know, the message that the girls are getting?
Well, you know, that's it's interesting because I think I kind of have two answers to that. I mean, obviously, when you look at the Disney stuff, that's always on there. But in a lot of ways, it doesn't seem to be what the girls are responding to so much. And you don't see like Prince Charming dolls on the shelves or anything like that. They're responding more to the bling than they are to that. But you know, earlier, Michael, you mentioned the hundreds of Cinderella stories. And one of the chapters that I write about is how much I love the traditional tales. And there are some really strong, self-directing girls in the traditional tales, including in the Grimm's Cinderella, as gross and gory as it is. And one of the things I love about that is that Cinderella, there's no fairy godmother, there's no, you know, pumpkin, none of that. Cinderella plants, she's called Aschenputtel, Ash Girl. She plants a hazel branch on her mother's grave and waters it with her tears. And the tree comes up and it's the tree, the spirit of her dead mother, who helps her when she needs help. And it's very much a story of coming of age and the guidance of the spirit of her mother. And to me, the message of that Cinderella ultimately is that we need to be that hazel tree with our branches helping guide our girls through their through this culture to be women.
Well, there's been a lot of work, of course, on American fairy tales and how they the kind of impact they had. I mean, if you're a stepmother, you're stepping into something, so to speak, because of the evil stepmothers and all of that. But
yeah.
I'm also struck by how so many of these stories seem to dovetail for you. I mean, Ariel and the Little Mermaid, Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, Belle in Belle and the Beast. The messages are still pretty clear in the way that they're coming across to our children.
Yeah, there's a series of great YouTube videos that this woman from Second City TV did that just cracked me up, where she's talking about lessons I learned from the fairy tale princesses or from the Disney princesses, something like that. And she's, you know, she says, like, with Ariel, it's like, well, what I learned is you should give up your voice to get a man. They're very amusing.
What a metaphor, huh?
Yeah.
Chris, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I'm the father of a 6-year-old and 4-year-old, and we went very much through the whole Disney princess production in life. And I thought what Disney was putting out there was absolutely age-appropriate. It is wholesome, it's innocent, it's singing, it's dancing, and all on their own accord, they've grown out of that. My 6-year-old's wearing a San Francisco Giants jersey because pitchers and catchers have reported to spring training. And we struggle very much to provide age-appropriate content for our kids. There's no Hannah Montana, there's no Britney Spears, because those aren't things that we want to expose our kids to. And at the end of the day, this conversation is, oh, Disney's an evil thing, when really at the end of the day, if you are just being a parent and discussing what your kids are seeing and trying to show them age-appropriate things, I really don't have a problem with what Disney's putting out.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. The book is really not a full-scale attack on Disney per se, but I think that you're right that it is about, to a degree, it's about parenting. And one of the things that I hoped with this book was that it would provide a kind of context so that whatever choices you make, whether you make the same choices I did or not about where you draw your lines and what you let in your house and how you talk to your daughter, that you do it intentionally and that you see sort of what, you know, what the culture is telling your daughter that she should be, that she should like, you know, how the arc is going from the princess culture to the diva culture to the new line of makeup from Walmart for 8 to 12-year-old girls, you know, how that all works so that you can think about it yourself and you can provide alternatives and you can talk to your kids.
But I was struck by, Chris, what you said about this being wholesome. And he judges this as wholesome, and probably a lot of people out there in America do, don't they?
Well, I think, you know, it can be. There are aspects, I mean, princess play, royal play, fantasy play, role play, all of that, you know, that is a very, very important part of childhood. Imagination is an important part of childhood. Playing by the script, not such a good part of childhood. You know, you don't want to be acting the script out over and over and over. And there are, you know, some of the princess movies, you know, I love Mulan. Tangled. Now, it's interesting. Tangled. So she's a semi-empowered, you know, let's just say she's a semi-empowered princess and not do a feminist takedown of it. We'll just say semi-empowered princess. But go on to Toys R Us website and you'll see that the most popular products being marketed from Tangled are the Tangled Mega Cosmetics Kit, the Tangled Compact Mirror, the Tangled Hair Braider, and the Tangled Vanity Table and Vanity Mirror. And
so the problem is more mass marketing, isn't it?
The problem is not just mass marketing. It's the marketing of a particular image of girlhood
from a very young age. Exactly.
Yeah, of beauty and appearance. And so when this Walmart line got rolled out, what they said was girls are wearing clear lip gloss and nail polish at 3 and 4 so that by age 8, this is their quote, naturally interested in enhancement. And you know, I think when we're in a situation where your daughter is going to miss her school bus because she hasn't put her face on that morning, we really do have to question whether it's so wholesome.
It's the whole culture. I mean, I'm thinking about how you look at the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine and everything is geared toward, you know, getting him, keeping him, making him happy in bed, all those kinds of sexual things mainly. Now they have, you know, children's version, teen versions of Cosmopolitan, and they're not as extreme, obviously, as the adult versions. I mean, they're not talking about the anatomy in quite the same way or anything like that. But what they're talking about is still the same idea of you make yourself pretty and you get boys and you be popular and you do all those kinds of things.
Well, again, it's about, you know, that's about defining yourself from the outside in instead of the inside out. And it's, again, this difference between sexuality, which is this healthy internal thing, and sexualization, which is what girls are encouraged to become, which is about being desirable rather than feeling your own desire. And the big change is, you know, Michael, when I wrote my first book, Schoolgirls, I came on your show, and that was in 1994, and we were talking about many of these issues, but we were talking about them with 12 and 13-year-old girls, and that was seeming young, that we were worrying about this with our 12 and 13-year-olds.
Now
we're
talking
about
it. 8?
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and that is a profound shift.
We'll go to more of our callers. We'll bring you in, Bernie, or is it Barry? I'm sorry.
It's Barry. Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling from Berkeley. I am a child care provider for the last 15 years and am the lucky mother of boy-girl four-and-a-half-year-old twins and am really enjoying watching them grow together. You know, they're in the same environment constantly. I am still providing care for other people's children. And, you know, the dolls and the trucks, we have all of those things. And the crossover play from one side to the other is regular, daily, hourly. It's really been a joy to watch this. And the thing I feel, you know, my son will try on Halloween costumes for the witch, and my daughter puts on her brother's night costumes, and they play and have a wonderful time together. My biggest thing is I would like to let them explore either side of their personalities, because I think we all have that in us, and modeling behavior, I think, is the biggest and most important thing as far as raising our daughters these days, is that we model good behavior and watch our kids flourish in that.
Absolutely. I mean, again, parenting is a big role, and one of the things that I have is on my website, which is just my name, or you can do CinderellaAteMyDaughter.com, is a list of resources to help parents, not so much, you know, restrict and deny and ban, but to offer to expand. Because if you say no, no, no to your daughter all the time, it's going to be really hard to convince her that you're giving her broader choices. So you need to think, you need to find other models of femininity and that are joyful and celebratory and that you can imbue with excitement and that she can embrace. But that said about the parenting, you know, it is very hard because if you go into Target, if you go into Walmart, if you go into Pottery Barn Kids, anywhere on the economic spectrum, and you try to buy clothes or you try to buy toys, it is like church and state in there. I mean, you can. It's very hard to find alternatives to pink, pretty, and sassy in the stores.
Can I read it? I want to read a number of emails here. This is from Margaret, who writes, if you go to Toys R Us, there are toys and then there is the pink section. Even Legos has a pink section. Mm-hmm. It's insane. The Disney movies also teach a demented lesson to girls. Little Mermaid, don't speak and you'll get your man. Beauty and the Beast, you can tame an abusive man. Snow White and others, a man will rescue you. Here's a listener named Patrice who says, Dear Ms. Ornstein and Dr. Krasny, I recently visited the local Pottery Barn Kids at Corte Madera, and I was absolutely horrified at the pinkness of all the items marketed to girls and the drab plaidness of all the stuff marketed to boys. I tried unsuccessfully to find an address to write a complaint to. Who is this marketing person? Trend. Are there no greens, yellows, oranges, purples available for girls? Nothing but primary colors for boys? It's atrocious. I thought we'd come further than this sort of Barbie Ken G.I. Joe mentality. At least these toys used a different palette once in a while. We didn't purchase anything, and we won't. And here's a listener who says, I'm not sure I understand why this is being presented as a new thing in some way. Since the inception of Disneyland in 1955, for example, and probably since the beginning of time, the idea of princesses seems to be part of every generation. So everything old is new again. Is this really something to worry about, or just a new generation of parents deciding to invest a massive amount of energy into a very small thing? And if this is a bad thing, and all this time is invested, isn't Peggy just creating a self-fulfilling prophecy, or perhaps more likely, this is just a way for Peggy to feed on fears in order to sell books?
Oh, yeah. I don't even know how to respond to that. I'm kind of guessing that that person hasn't been in a store lately. I don't know. You know, that Pottery Barn Kids comment is really interesting because that was one of the places that I sort of went, oh, my God, I wanted to buy, you know, crib sheets. You want to buy crib sheets. You don't want to necessarily have them have be pink and have flowers or be blue and have trucks. You want to find something that's just a kid thing. And it really doesn't exist. And what's interesting about it is that a catalog writer for Pottery Barn Kids told me that they have tried to have more crossover items, and they don't sell. So there is a way that it's not just them, but it's the parents who are reinforcing and demanding this. And, you know, and I wouldn't say it's as old as time. I mean, as I said, the, you know, royal play, yeah. Fantasy play, yeah. But having a $4 billion industry with 26,000 products, nuh-uh. That is new. And pink, too, is pink as an all-consuming thing. Relatively new. Pink didn't come in. Pink and blue, when they first came in 1900.
It was a shift, wasn't it?
Pink was for boys. Blue was for girls.
Pink was also the color of the gay rights movement for a while before it became rainbow.
That too.
I mean, but, lots of different
pink,
faces.
Yes, yeah. Pink was, and even in the Disney movies, Cinderella has a blue dress and little Michael in Peter Pan has a pink PJ. In the 60s, somebody sent me a picture of Michael Reagan wearing an all pink suit. So it really was not so defined.
Tom Wolfe used to wear pink suits, too.
Yeah. And what that pink tells girls, not only is this, you know, that it fuses girlhood with appearance and kind of consumerism, but it also tells them, you know, that what's pink is for them and what's not pink is not for them. And once I was taking Daisy scootering, you know how when you're in the car, you hear the best stuff right in the back seat. And we were with a little friend of hers who had a pink Hello Kitty helmet, and Daisy's was a fire-breathing dragon helmet. And Daisy, the little girl, said, your helmet's not pink. It's not for girls. And Daisy said, well, it's for boys or for girls. And the other girl kind of, you know, looked skeptical. And I thought, wow, you know, there's so much in there about what girls are supposed to want. You know, the suspicion, if you don't want that, if you're a little different. And just this ever-shrinking pink box that defines girlhood through spa makeovers at 4 and, you know, spa birthday parties and makeovers and princesses and pink.
Here's a web comment. I have two little girls, age 3 and 1. Before even having them, having my son, age 5, first, I always criticize the overemphasis on princesses by my friends who were parents. I have long said that I don't want my daughters to worship princesses, as they have very few redeeming qualities that I want my girls to think are important. I am glad this is becoming a view that is being shared more widespread. I have long wondered what I will do if, like my friend parents say, my daughters choose to love princesses despite my lack of encouragement. Luckily, my 3-year-old has followed my lead so far and worships Dora most and will choose alternative toys over princesses many times. Thank you for spreading this word. Then there's this email. A whole generation of women, I'm 52, were raised to believe that you could not be overtly feminine, certainly could not be girly girl, and be taken seriously in this man's world. I am really enjoying seeing the younger generation of women my 20-something son's ages, who can be girly and still be in the PhD program. Look at the Cuddy character in House, the dean of medicine, who wears 5-inch heels, pencil skirts, and cleavage-revealing sweaters. I've always loved pink, full skirts and tiaras. I love being a ballerina, but I had to leave those loves behind in my childhood. You didn't get a business degree in pink frills, but now you can, and I think that's a good thing.
I don't know. You really think Cuddy in real life that would be okay? I mean, that's a TV show. I hate to tell you. But, you know, this is the thing. It's not about not being feminine. And it's not even about not playing princess occasionally. It is about that this has become the only game in town and that it's too narrow. And that it needs expanding, and we need to have other ideas of what, like, for instance, you know, one thing we did was we read a lot of Greek myths, a lot of child-friendly Greek myths. And so Daisy went on Halloween dressed as Athena. And Athena, you know, great costume. She still gets to wear the toga. She gets to wear that thing on her head. But it's a really different vision and image and idea of what it means to be feminine than the Disney Cinderella.
Remember the feminist fairy tales and the fractured fairy tales? Maybe parents
I like fractured fairy tales. Bullwinkle?
Read them along with the regular fairy tales.
Well, there's a lot of really great fairy tales out there. And that, you know, again, I'm not trying to, you know, overplug my website, but it's easier than having to list them. But, you know, for people who are interested, it's just, you know.
Is Athena really popular among kids, though? Do the kids know who Athena is?
Well, in Berkeley. But, you know, we have gotten to a point where we think that this is normal, that it's normal for girls to do this and only this. So when I went into Daisy's preschool, they were doing a thing where they filled in a blank. The kids were filling a blank. Like if I were a blank, I'd blank to a store. So if I were a ball, I'd roll to the store. And the boys had filled it in. You know, they had done Lightning McQueen and superheroes, but they had done puppies, raisins, cookies, fish. You know, I mean, this whole range of things. The girls had chosen exactly four things: butterfly, princess, fairy, ballerina. And one was a butterfly, princess, fairy, ballerina because she was very ambitious. But the teacher was surprised because she said it didn't used to be that way. They didn't used to be so narrow in their ideas of what it meant to be, you know, what girls would pick. And, you know, it's just, if that's all they can think of, that is not expanding their imaginations. It's just too narrow.
We'll go to more of your calls. Nancy from Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi. This is interesting, but I don't know. I think a lot of it, as people have said, has to do with parenting and also with kids that your kids are friends with. And I have a 43-year-old daughter. We used to call her the fairy princess when she was little. And she, you know, she was into this stuff. She is now an extraordinarily capable, independent, terrific young woman. I have a granddaughter who's almost 10, who was definitely into princesses and stuff until she was around 8, and then that was that. Her best friend is a little boy. She is a terrific soccer player, and we got her into a private school in San Francisco where the kids are definitely not into this stuff at all. So I really think it's what you do with your child and who you know, what you present to your child and who their friends are and role models. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the princess things when they're little. But you do have to give them alternatives. And, you know, a lot of this is because the parents push this stuff and push it way beyond where it should be, you know, okay. But a lot is, as I said, my daughter was in, you know, into this, and, you know, she left it way behind.
Nancy, clearly.
Right, and yeah. I would say, Nancy, a couple things. First of all, your daughter's 43, so that means that she wasn't, you know, that's kind of like saying we had a television with 5 channels when I was a kid, and now we have a satellite dish, and it's the same thing. You know, there's an order of magnitude that's happened that's really, really different from when your daughter was a child. And secondly, yes, you're right, absolutely, and that's what's so hopeful, is that by parenting intentionally and by thinking about your kids' friends, by thinking about your community, by thinking about what you present to her, by offering her alternatives, you can balance this out. But the problem is that right now, for so many girls in so many communities, in so many families, it's not being balanced out and it's going in this very different direction.
Well, here's a predictable email. You probably get these. This Stephen writes, "What about Spider-Man captured my son? This isn't just a problem for parents with little girls. My 18-month-year-old is already learning to scream and jump like superheroes from the 3-year-old in our nanny share."
Can I just say, I would recommend to him the book Packaging Boyhood by Lynn Michael Brown and Sharon Lamb, because that's a great book on the marketing of masculinity. And I think that, you know, as always, boys have their issues, girls have their issues, but I happen to write about girls.
Well, as long as you're recommending, here's a listener, Elizabeth, who says, I'm 5 years from having a teenage daughter. What two things should I do now, or two books I should read to get ready? And she adds parenthetically, we've still got a pile of princess stuff my two daughters still play with.
Oh, gosh, there's so many things you could do with that one. You know, I would look into...
read Peggy's book, first of all.
You can read Cinderella Ain't My Daughter. I would look into Girls Leadership Institute, which is a great program in this area. I would look into Odd Girl Out is a great book. I would look into Spark online. Those would be a few things I'd suggest.
And Madison, South Dakota. Chuck, join us. Hi.
Yes, how are you? My wife and I are grandparents to a 5.5-year-old granddaughter. We've been very concerned about the image to young girls that we've seen portrayed in their television shows. And as an example of that, about 6 months ago, we were visiting them, and I went to give my granddaughter a goodnight kiss. She threw her head back up, closed her eyes, and puckered up. I was horrified, absolutely horrified. And we had to have a talk with her parents. Ooh. To explain to her that what she sees on television isn't always the best thing for someone her age.
Yeah, especially when you're kissing your grandfather or something like that. I think a point well taken, and I thank you for that, Chuck. Maybe on that message, we should go out with some princess music here. Peggy Ornstein, good to have had you on with us. Thank you so much. Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the New Girly Girl Culture by Peggy Ornstein.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.